with information on the latest developments in assistive technology and initiatives from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. RPH Australia brings you AbleQuest. Hello, I'm Marnie Roper. In the last program, we discussed the increasing prevalence of Alzheimer's disease and its huge impact on individuals, the family, and the community. Alzheimer's disease is the most common type of dementia, which was the third leading cause of death in 2010. This is the second of two segments on a new Alzheimer's disease self-assessment test to help the public identify which common risk factors they have and what they can do about them. Until now, apart from undergoing medical tests, there has been no method of easily assessing the future risk of getting Alzheimer's. However, an evidence-based solution has now been developed by a team led by Professor Karen Anstey and Dr. Nicolas Cherbuon in the Centre for Research on Ageing, Health and Wellbeing at the ANU College of Medicine, Biology and Environment. The ANU Alzheimer's Disease Risk Index has been designed to predict those who are at increased risk of developing Alzheimer's. The results arm people with the ability to help themselves by reducing risk factors and increasing protective factors. Anyone can take the online test free of charge by entering ANU ADRI into the search engine and the page will be presented. It takes approximately 20 minutes and the information and results are confidential. Dr. Nicolas Cherbuon, ARC Future Fellow and Director of the Neuroimaging and Brain Laboratory at the Centre, joined us by phone. Continuing the discussion, Barbara Sullivan asked Dr. Cherbuon what the main objectives were in developing the test.
Yes, our objectives are multiple. I mean, really, we want to influence Australians' health for the better and global health for the better. The realisation that there are a number of risk factors for dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and the fact that there is no cure and no effective treatment at the moment, made us think that we had to step back and look at where we could make a big difference. Because the population is aging, because certain risk factors such as obesity and low physical activity are increasing, we really need to make people aware in the population earlier in life that these things are important and they can do something about it. So yes, it's about literacy, it's about telling people what the disease is, how we can influence it, how our behaviour makes a difference, and give effective information about how to go about it. What can I eat? How much physical exercise should I do?
Yes, so if you said one of the protective risk factors is light to moderate alcohol consumption, why is that? What do you consider to be light to moderate?
Light to moderate is what the WHO considers light to moderate, and this is what the NHMRC recommended previously, but now the guidelines have changed. But broadly, it's 7 to 14 standard drinks per week for women and about 7 to 28 standard drinks for men. We're not sure exactly about the bracket because this information comes from epidemiological studies where people report their consumption and it might not be completely exact, but what the research shows consistently is that those people who abstain from drinking alcohol tend to be at higher risk. One very important point to make at this stage is that what we are not saying is we're not saying that people should start drinking if they're currently abstaining from drinking.
Right.
What we're saying is that if one drinks moderate amounts of alcohol, we know it's protective and there is no need to be concerned about this. If levels are high, it's probably wise to decrease them in the moderate range. And we don't have enough evidence to advise anything to those people who don't drink because it may be that the reason they don't drink is because alcohol interacts with their body in certain ways.
Yes.
And they're different. And we're not sure what should be done in this context.
So for those of us who can, that glass of red wine at night is not going to be a problem.
No, on the contrary.
And as we sit and eat our fish as well, if you talk about high fish intake, what sort? Do they have to be high in omega-3 oils?
Yes, we believe that oily fish, which has high levels of omega-3, or omega-3 supplement from fish, are protective. Normally, the recommendation is about 3 meals a week with fish or omega-3 supplementation. There is quite strong evidence showing this protective effect.
And physical activity, you talk about high physical activity. What does high mean? I guess that depends on age.
It's somewhat difficult one to answer as well, because the computation in the tool is quite complex. It takes into consideration responses about how much physical activity one does during the work hour, during leisure, or doing gardening. But as a guide, medium levels of physical activity would be walking about 3 hours a week, in addition to having normal physical activity during work and during the day, doing the washing up and mowing the lawn and so on. Or about 100 minutes of cycling, a bit more than an hour and a half, or 150 minutes of other moderate activities. Vigorous activity is about five times these amounts. Now, if 3 hours of walking is moderate activity, we don't mean necessarily 15 hours of walking during the week. It's usually because people jog and therefore have, for the same amount of time, have more vigorous activities.
So talking of activity, what about cognitive activity? What do you exactly mean? I mean, just being at work, reading a book, is it more specific than that?
This is one area that we're really working hard at the moment to clarify, because again, the evidence comes from longitudinal studies that show people who develop dementia might engage less in cognitive activities, and many of the questions are a bit limiting. So it does mean reading or going to the museum or listening to music. It's really activities that strain the brain somewhat. What physical activity is to the body, cognitive activity is to the brain. It sort of trains it at doing what it does better. But although our questions in our questionnaire do not cover all activities, it's thought that if you engage in intense thinking at work, this is likely to contribute to decreasing your risk. But it might be watching intently certain documentaries, reading newspapers and magazines, doing crosswords, and other activities of this type.
So just picking up what you had talked about earlier about risk factors and just concentrating on those for the time being, you talked about increasing age is one, and low education, overweight, depression. Now, you've got noted female gender. Why is that? Is that historic? I mean, based on a generation who were more stay-at-home and perhaps less active, or are females more prone to Alzheimer's?
It's not really a generational issue, we think. I think possibly women in the past engaged less in certain sports, but women have always been very active, you know, around the kitchen and around the garden. Progressively, these activities have been more shared with men, although women still do more of them. So we think that it's more related to the effects of genes and hormones, and a slightly higher propensity for women to develop this type of disease. But we don't understand it fully.
I know pesticide exposure you've got there, that's presumably any sort of pesticide spray, whether it's your garden or if you live in a district where there's aerial spraying.
Again, this is a developing area, so we can't tell exactly which pesticides might be, or herbicide even, might be more dangerous. But it's really mostly for those people who deal with these products on almost daily or weekly basis, particularly people on the land or people who use these products as part of their work.
Now, back to the test. How do you tell if the test is accurate?
That's a very important point. Because of evidence-based approach, we were very keen not to just develop a test or an assessment with a scientific method, but also then go on to validate it, to assess whether it really did what it said it did. So the way we went about this is that we collaborated with a number of researchers working on three international studies which had the information or some of the information required to test the validity of our assessment. And we used the data that followed people over time with information on different risk factors, and which also showed which of these individuals eventually developed dementia. And with these data, we were able to see how accurate our risk index was. Mm. And we showed in research that is now published and freely available on the internet that it was valid, and although not perfect, it did what it did quite well.
And do you think there could be psychological implications for people who test positive?
As always, when we hear bad news, different people might react differently. But an important point to make here is that it's not so much that one tests positive or negative. They learn about their risk profile. So it's right. not about, I conduct this assessment and then I learn that I have or I haven't got Alzheimer's disease. What it tells us is that we might be at higher risk of developing the disease later. So we should take this as a positive, even if there are things that we're not doing right, because what it's telling us is a number of things we're doing quite well, and where we are not, there is time now to work on these to improve our risk profile. So hopefully people taking the assessment won't feel too negatively about the results. We really went out of our way to formulate the advice in a positive way and say it doesn't really matter whether you take this assessment when you're 40, 50, 60 or later. There is always something we can do to decrease our risk. Of course, it's somewhat more effective if we start early.
And how are you going to publicise the existence of the test, Nick?
We're trying to do this in multiple ways. So first, publicise it to the scientific community and to clinicians so that they can recommend it. One point worthwhile mentioning is that because a report can be printed at the end, people can take the assessment and print it and then take it to their GP if they've got concerns and discuss it with the clinician. We are also developing interventions to decrease risk profile, to give more advice to people about how to change their behaviour. And we're including this tool in these interventions. And hopefully, when we have results coming out of these interventions, it will publicise the tool further. We're also collaborating with Alzheimer's Australia to publicise this tool, and they have been very supportive, and we've got an ongoing collaboration about this. And of course, through the media, it's been mentioned in a number of websites and through programs such as yours. So we encourage people to visit our website and contact us if they've got feedback.
Well, thank you very much for sharing this information with us, Nick. It's extremely interesting. And I, for one, will be off to do the test.
Wonderful.
So thank you. We look forward to coming back in the months to come and hearing about your progress.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dr. Nicola Sherbuan from the Centre for Research on Ageing, Health and Wellbeing at ANU in Canberra, speaking with Barbara Sullivan. Remember, the easiest way to take the test is to enter the word ANU ADRI into the search engine. You have just been listening to AbleQuest, a program that looks at developments in assistive technology. From Barbara Sullivan and Marnie Roper, thank you for listening and goodbye till next program.